This year, during BC Museums Week, the BC Museums Association is highlighting how museums, galleries, and cultural centers are defying expectations and reimagining the very idea of what a museum is and does. This afternoon, we're discussing how museums can create a more inclusive future. The BCMA is grateful for the support of this year's event sponsors. You can visit our website to learn more about them and their services. Today, we are discussing how museums can create a more inclusive future. On to our presenters, Ryan Hunt and Dr. Henry Yu.
Thank you so much, Lorenda, and welcome everyone who's joining us for this special BC Museums Week webinar. As was said, I'm Ryan Hunt, pronouns he, him. I'm the director of the BC Museums Association, and I'm joining you today from my home in central Saanich on the sovereign unceded territories of the Wasanich people, specifically on Llewellyn-New, the mountain. And I'm so pleased to be joined today by Dr. Henry Yu, who will be talking about a new partnership between the BC Museums Association and the UBC. And this is where I always have to check my notes because acronyms disappear from my head the minute I read them. The UBC Center for Asian Canadian Research and Engagement, henceforth being called ACRE. Welcome, Dr. Yu.
Thanks, Ryan, and please call me Henry. I have doctors in the family, and yes, I have a doctorate, but I will keep looking behind me for someone in a medical coat if you keep referring to me as doctor. Yeah, but it's great to be here, and thanks so much for BCMA inviting me.
So yes, sorry, hey, we just had peek behind the curtain. We just had the conversation about me calling you Henry, and then I immediately forgot that. Apologies. No. So tell me a bit, because ACRE is a very new research institute at the University of British Columbia. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, and you know, ACRE is actually bringing together some units that have already been working together and in partnership with quite a few museums. And, you know, I know some of those folks from various museums that we have been working with over the years, last 5 years, are probably in the audience today. So a big shout out to them. And, you know, we've been really happy with the way that we've gotten students involved. We've gotten our research and teaching involved at UBC with a lot of things going on at museums. And I think the ACRE itself is bringing together some of those units, including the teaching units, Asian Canadian, Asian Migration Studies, a minor program that a lot of students sort of add on as to their degrees. But for us, it's been really about helping UBC become engaged with this very important sector of public education that museums represent, you know, the way in which K through 12 students and the general public learns about who we are, where we are, as well as, you know, the world in general. And just full disclosure, I'm a bit of a museum geek myself. I love museums. I've always loved it, even as a child. And so to me, this ACRE, this new center, is about partnering the various university units. And for those outside of UBC UBC is like a huge entity. It's like, you know, 60,000 students, 10,000 faculty and staff. There's so many things going on. And for us, a center is a way to have a center of gravity to pull together, you know, these units. And the key ones right now that ACRE represents are those that have been involved already in working with Asian Canadian communities, as well as museum partners and things like that. So it's a beginning. It's built on existing relationships, but the beginning part is to actually have this commitment And that comes out of the National Forum on Anti-Asian Racism, which UBC helped host last June, which, because of the spectacular nature of anti-Asian violence and racism that really began to flare, that, you know, this is part of a commitment by UBC to work to support and help, you know, the communities we serve in, I think, the very important goal of combating racism. So it's about anti-racism in general, but specifically anti-Asian racism through the forum last year.
Well, you bring up anti-Asian racism, which has been in the news a lot in the past 2 years. Do you feel that sometimes, though, anti-Asian racism is framed as something that's happened a lot in the past 2 years, and conversations around it ignore the deep historical roots in Canada? And do you think that museums have sufficiently been addressing the topic of anti-Asian racism?
That's a great question. Thanks. Thanks for raising it, because, you know, I get a lot of phone calls I'm a historian by training. And so I often get phone calls when there's some racist incident, elderly women being, assaulted, physically punched while waiting for the bus. You know, there's all these horrific things that have been happening for the last couple of years. But even before the last couple of years, I get phone calls and journalists will say, can you explain this? Can you tell us? And often what that is an awareness that there's this longer history right from the founding of British Columbia of the, our province and our nation being created around white supremacy. And that created various forms of racism, not just anti-Chinese and anti-Asian racism, this very particular form of exclusion in terms of immigration exclusion, of violence as well, but also obviously the most important, the kind of colonial displacement, takeover, dispossession of indigenous land and territory from indigenous peoples who have been here for time immemorial. And so that connection historically of a long legacy that has not been erased or solved or cured or whatever you want to use as a metaphor with what are current examples of racism and anti-Asian racism. I think that's something that a lot of people perhaps don't understand, the relationship of the past and the present, that just because now we have repudiated the values of white supremacy, we are no longer trying to build a white man's province, which was an actual political slogan, or a white Canada forever, another political slogan that got people elected when non-whites could not vote, when Indigenous peoples, were basically treated as non-entities. That those days are over in terms of our values, but that doesn't mean we have completely dismantled those institutions that were set up. And I think that's where museums play such a crucial role, because for much of the history of BC, you could say that museums were one of the main tools for advancing a story of colonial takeover, of this being a place that was built for, white settlers and white migrants, or those from Europe and others who counted as white, and that others didn't belong. That if you were Asians, you didn't belong. If you were counted as Indigenous, you need to be cleared away and, forgotten in some sense, but also forced into becoming, and like the settlers who came, and to lose who you were. And so those are all entwined processes. I think one of the things that we became painfully aware of during the last few years is, UBC worked with Angus Reid Institute to do a survey of high school students. And what was perhaps a good sign was that in that survey, half of high school students in Canada had heard of residential schooling. So that's very different than, say, 15, 20 years ago. That was a sign of hope that places like museums and education, K through 12, could change the awareness in Canada of something that for a long time had been ignored or suppressed or erased. But the bad news was that awareness of high school students of the history of anti-Asian racism, of the head tax, of the Komagata-Maru, of the removal of Japanese Canadians, the exclusion of South Asians through the Continuous Journey Act, very low awareness. you know, for something like iconic, like Japanese Canadian removal, was 1 in 5 high school students in Canada had even heard of that. For others, it was much lower, you know. And so that means we've got a lot of work to do, and museums have to play a role in rethinking the history of Canada that we are teaching to our youth. I'm tired. I think a lot of people are tired, especially after the last couple of years, of people being surprised when they hear of a racist incident or feeling a kind of shock. It's like, oh, I thought this wouldn't happen anymore. And that's actually one of the outcomes of an erasure of our history, is that we are continually surprised and shocked when something happens, because we think somehow racism ended or racism's over. And I was kind of cheekily ask, when did that happen? What was the date of that again? You know, I'm a historian, and I'm supposed to, when did racism end in Canada again? Can you tell me the date? And I think that's one of the ways, it's like, yeah, when did it suddenly end? When did we stop being this country that did that? We don't want to be that anymore. So for me, it's about a future, and the K through 12 education. The future is newcomers who don't know the history often of Canada, and how do they learn it in places like museums? So yeah, so to me, museums are all important.
Yeah, you know, I think as well for me that museums have a responsibility of helping to educate communities, Canadians, about the past. And when people say things like racism is over in Canada, or I had never heard of residential schools, or I'm surprised that unmarked graves are being found across the country, I view that as, you know, in part a failure of our sector to tell these stories and have these difficult conversations through our organizations. Through your many roles at UBC, you've been able to connect with museums and connect students with museums to try to find new ways of telling stories. Can you talk a little bit about some of the partnerships you've helped to facilitate between UBC and museums?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to, because they've been so rewarding. And again, we've had quite a few. So I for those, if I don't mention you, it doesn't mean that I think less of the relationship we've had. But and just to give an example of, one that has been year after year, was with Burnaby Village Museum. And why I point this out is both because Burnaby Village Museum itself was created as a kind of pioneer celebration of a particular story of Burnaby being settled in a certain way by European migrants and, you know, farming implements and these. And that's one aspect of Burnaby Village Museum's its own history as a museum, but also this key role. Burnaby Village Museum has more K through 12 sort of visits in terms of field trips and things than really any other museum in the Lower Mainland. So for us, it was this wonderful partnership, and I'll give a lot of credit to San Pleshikov and Cod and Jane and Lorendo and all these other people who were really, I think, to me, committed. And that I would also throw in a lot of people who worked there for a while, Elwin Shea and others in terms of the interpretive staff, who wanted this place to tell a story that resonated with Burnaby now and was a kind of forward-looking place that that could bring again people in Burnaby but also Canadians together. And so some of the things we did was we had students every summer, as sort of research assistants, helping develop ideas on how what the wonderful people at Burnaby Village Museum were doing could reach audiences better. And this is coming from 18 to 22 year, 20 or 3 year olds who could really imagine, I'm from a family that maybe is Chinese Canadian, or Punjabi Sikh Canadian, and how to really begin to imagine a different way for people to interact with the spaces of BVM. And again, I'll give a big shout out to Denise Fong, our research director at UBC, who worked at the museum as a researcher, continues to work close to the city of Burnaby. So for us, partnerships with museums are long-term commitments, that these are relationships that the students may change summer to summer and come and go, so to speak. But our goals, what we're trying to achieve, are systemic changes, you know, and we're so proud to see how things like the herbalist shop at Bernalillo Village Museum, a place underinterpreted, frankly, from a kid's point of view, you know, it kind of scared my kids when they went in before. And now it's a place that I think is welcoming. It tells a story, a very vibrant story of Chinese Canadians in Burnaby, of Chinese medicine. It's a very welcoming space. And so to me, those are the kinds of changes that we can really be proud of. And our students played a real key role in imagine this, and the professional staff at BVM and the interpreters, they've really been wonderful collaborators. So that's an example. As I said, there's been other examples of us working with Gulf of Georgia Cannery, again, in terms of this wonderful project called Fish Tales, which I encourage a lot of people to go find on social media, which again is to think about seafood consumption among people in Richmond, especially populations like Chinese Canadian and other, again, less well-represented Asian Canadian communities, which now really are a big part of Richmond's demographics. And yet, you know, how do they, encouraging how them in feeling connected to the Gulf of Georgia Cannery. Again, Richmond Museum, the Chinese Canadian Museum, which we helped really build and create. And so for us, we're excited in these kind of very real processes of working with museums, large and small. Again, the under-resourcing of the kind of cultural sector in BC is something we're all aware of, that compared to other provinces, we don't invest enough in our cultural sector. We have many under-resourced museums. And UBC, we're not going to solve this, you know, but we can bring some of our capacity and resources, especially those things that we specialize in, which is with research, but also this supply of 18 to 22 year olds to make it a little bit, you know, that we have an endless supply. It's, you know, every year of these wonderful undergraduate students, the best in the world, from around the world, with multiple language skills, you know, many are multilingual, you know, and to be able to bring that to help, again, museums do things that otherwise would be very difficult for them to do. You know, bringing cultural background and personal experiences, familial pasts, but also those language and research skills that make our students, you know, it keeps me young just working with them and learning so much from our students. So often people think, you know, a job as a professor is to, you know, some one way direction, teach young people. It's actually much more dynamic, and it goes both ways. I learn things constantly from our students, and to be able to share that privilege with, I think, museums and their staff and their publics is to me really exciting about where we are right now.
You bring up the partnership with Gulf of Georgia Cannery Museum, which is, you know, a site of food production. And in looking at some of the other partnerships that both Acre and Instruct have had with museums, yeah, it seems like a lot of them center around food and food production. And I was looking at your website and found a quote that says that food has and continues to be a medium for civic engagement for migrant communities across the city. Yeah. And I think from, you know, I am a white male of British ancestry, and I think for that kind of classical museum audience, you don't necessarily associate food and drink with museums. You know, sometimes drink especially is seen as the enemy of a museum, something you're not allowed to bring in. Yeah. Your virtual background now is a Chinese restaurant. I was just wondering, like, what's the power of food for museums?
You've opened up this incredible Pandora's box of good things. To me, it's like it's like when you get these food packages, if you've got a good friend and you're not feeling well, and you get this nice big food package of things, so that to me, food is everything. And again, I'm not going to talk about our history of British cuisine and comparing British cuisine to other cuisines. That's someone else can say whether McDonald's is an example of Scottish cuisine or not, or whatever. But let's just say We are benefiting the city from an incredible food culture in restaurants, in home life, because of this diversity in every part of our city. All these small restaurants that are family run, that literally bring food traditions and then adapt them, you know, to the local place. That to me, you know, we used to have this project about 15 years ago when I first came, called Eating Global Vancouver, which was our students would make these short films, just interviewing not just the owners of these small restaurants all across Vancouver, you know, who came from other parts of the world and were, you know, sharing really their cuisine and culture, but also the customers who were there, the people who worked there. And so for those interested, there's a couple good examples. If you just Google, you know, UBC and Green Lettuce, a wonderful Chinese Indian restaurant on Kingsway near Victoria, Jangmo Jib, the Korean restaurant. These were films that were made over a decade ago, but they were also a part of, in my mind, how to bring people together. We all have to eat. So, you know, I always say, let's have a lunch meeting because, you know, I got to eat anyway. So let's break bread together, or let's eat noodles together, or let's have sushi together. The idea of learning across the table, you know, I'm principal of St. John's College, which is an international graduate college with 165 graduate students coming from over 40 different countries. And our motto is the world around our table, because all these people coming together from around the world, they share their interests, their work, their own really intellectual life, but also their cultural heritage, their background, the differences in the way they see the world, all around dinner. And it's very hard. I know we talk about fights at the dinner table, but one of the things about you can't go too far in a disagreement if you know you have to have breakfast together the next morning. And so food is a moderator. It provides a context for people to come together. It allows sharing and a kind of potluck. You know, I'll bring something, you bring something, and we'll all sort of partake. It lowers the tension in difficult discussions if you can do it over food, but it's also a way of sharing your own culture and your own heritage and what is so meaningful to you. And so a great example is we co-curated, Denise Fong and I and our team did a lot of the work in terms of community interviews and story sharing for A Seat at the Table at the Museum of Vancouver, another partnership we had. And for us, it revolved around food. It had to be around food, because this was, you know, A Seat at the Table had that double meaning again of winning a seat at the table politically, overcoming exclusion, the resilience it took to kind of combat racism and to kind of thrive and survive despite white supremacy and exclusion, but also as a seat at the table in terms of happy memories that people have of celebrating birthdays at a Chinese restaurant, or you know, going to Dim Sum, and you know, some remarkable process in the 1970s when everybody, white males included, can order, you know, hagao and their shumai and their favorite, you know, dim sum. Like, think of that as this amazing process that Vancouver underwent, a place that was built around, again, white supremacy and anti-Asian, you know, racism, to be at a point where people eat sushi three times a day and they can order dim sum in Cantonese, using the right terms. That's a remarkable achievement for how far we've come as a society, but it also opens up a venue for us to have come together and have discussions about our past and our future collectively. And so to me, it's one of the wonderful ways, whether it's Gulf of George Cannery and the Fish Tales or A Seat at the Table, you know, as a exhibit, to bring people together around something that we all understand, you know, eating food, but the variations across the world are also a way to talk about difference, you know, and to talk over difference and through difference, and to again create something together. So yeah, you know, I'm not a big hybrid fusion cuisine kind of guy, but I like the idea of people coming together and creating local adaptations because of what's available in terms of menu, what's available in terms of fresh and learning from each other, like the Chinese smorgasbord, the all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet. It's invented here at the Marco Polo Lounge, you know, in the 1950s. And that's because we have so many people from Scandinavia. That's where the smorgasbord part comes. And the Louis brothers, when they created a all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet in Chinatown at the Marco Polo Lounge, they called it a Chinese smorgasbord. So that, to me, is this incredible example of how we learn from each other and how we mix things together and see it concretely in that history of the Chinese smorgasbord.
I did not know that. I'm a longtime fan of a Chinese smorgasbord, but I did not know that it is a BC creation.
It's a Vancouver achievement, and it's not good for you. Like, I, you know, some people overindulge, but just because you can, I always say, just because it says all you can eat doesn't mean you should. But it's ours. It's our gift to the world.
And, you know, thinking about, you know, outside of, you know, Lower Mainland, Greater Victoria area, just smaller communities, you know, and in having conversations with really small museums about things like diversity and inclusion, you'll often hear, you know, maybe not this explicitly worded, but people say like, well, you know, we'd love to highlight more stories, but, you know, there aren't more stories, you know, it's only white people in this community.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we don't know how to reach people who aren't white in our community. Yeah. Do you think that food is a tool for building those connections?
Well, I'm going to give you an example right now of my background. This is for those, some of you may recognize it if you've ever been in Lytton. This was actually the Lytton Hotel and the kind of Chinese cafe that was within the Lytton cafe. This photo was taken because we were doing a lot of work up in Lytton. The Chinese Lytton Chinese Museum, Lorna Fandrich created out of her love of this longer history. And so there's a couple of things I think that you prompted. One is, unfortunately, this place burned down last year. So, you know, we were really sad to, you know, out of, again, this ties to climate change and to the heat dome and all, and the kind of wildfires that are plaguing British Columbia. But that loss of this kind of space is also about recovering a history, a history of small town Chinese Canadian cafes. And they were called Chinese Canadian, not because they served Chinese food. Now, you know, this cafe behind me did serve Chinese food, but for much of the history of Chinese cafes, whether in small town BC or small towns across the prairies, all the way to the Maritimes, what made them Chinese was the person operating it, you know, not the food. And it's only really in the last part of the 20th century when more and more Chinese, you know, chow mein, chop suey, and things like that became more and more common on those menus. Things that if you went to China itself, you'd go, where's my sweet and sour pork with canned pineapple and, you know, electric yellow sweet and sour sauce? That's not really Chinese from China. This was an invention of Chinese American, Chinese Canadian overseas fare. But it's for us, food is, as you said, a way to bring people together, because these were often like little community centers for small towns, that they were the place where the Chinese cafe owners and those who ran it, you know, they welcomed everybody and anybody. You know, to me, one of the iconic ways of really understanding this is to read Fred Waugh's Diamond Grill, this wonderful sort of like series of almost tone poems, these essays that are an elegy to his, you know, upbringing in these small town cafes. And so for those of you interested who haven't, you know, I highly recommend Diamond Grill. And so for us, and just again, you know, like Bill Clinton, I come from a place called Hope. I was a child in Hope, BC. And so for me, and then I, you know, after that, the father was a mining engineer. So we moved around a lot. And so then I was in Colwood when he decided being a mining engineer was to do anymore. And so he opened a small store in Colwood, BC, again, a fairly small town. For me, small town BC, and there's a long history of actually Chinese Canadians and Asian Canadians in small towns, Japanese Canadians before they were removed en masse in 1942. And so actually the history of these towns are rich histories of indigenous unceded territory in BC, of of lots of different people coming from around the world, of miners, you know, coming from, you know, Cornish and Welsh mines, and Chinese coming as well as miners. And so to me, this rich history is an important part of history. I was the co-chair of the Legacy Initiatives Advisory Council in 2015, which identified a lot of these significant, historically significant sites that were rural BC, so to speak, small towns and rural places. And these were sites of significance that often only had now cemeteries left. You know, so there were, we knew the Chinese were there because there's Chinese cemeteries and there's headstones that have Chinese names. We know that they were there because there's still sometimes a Chinese Canadian cafe run by a more recent immigrant family, but generation after generation had been run by Chinese. We know that there was Chinese farms in many places in the interior that really helped raise vegetables and for market, sometimes in the Lower Mainland and Victoria, and it would be, but these were farms that were tied to vertically integrated systems, you know, very local, sustainable agricultural systems, whether in Burnaby, the Big Bend, you know, but also in Armstrong and up and down the interior. And so we're going to go on a road trip for those. We're going to go and take students in the summer and go to Vancouver Island with Imogene Lim, my colleague at Vancouver Island University, to go and it's going to be, I think our tentative title is like Food, Farms, and Funerals, to those different aspects of these historically significant sites. So for those interested in what's he talking about, the historical significance, the Heritage BC has a map of a lot of these sites that were recognized by the province of BC as historically significant for their ties to Chinese Canadian history. A similar process has happened with South Asian Canadian history, with Japanese Canadian history in BC. And so all of these are about surfacing a forgotten or erased history. And so this idea that small towns have always been very white, you know, to me, that takes some rethinking too, that that a lot of Chinese Canadians, for instance, left these small places and small towns in the 1940s and 50s for various reasons. But I would put it this way, the vast majority of Chinese Canadians before World War II were in rural places, a majority. After World War II, Chinese Canadians became majority urban, just like Canadians in general became increasingly urban. And so the depopulating of small towns and of rural places was an overall trend. And those who stayed, you know, those who are still there, I think, you know, they have a rich history. And to me, for those institutions, small town museums that are often run by volunteers, historical societies that are local, to me, that's where the University of British Columbia, we are the University of British Columbia, not the University of Vancouver, not the University of the Lower Mainland. We're a provincial university with a mandate to serve the whole province. And so for me, ACRE and our team, and just because of my own background, having lived and gone to school and you know, really have a devotion to these places that are often forgotten when we get too caught up with Vancouver and Victoria.
And, you know, you bring up the idea that almost that we have really short memories as communities in a lot of ways, that, you know, like you said, smaller communities were often more diverse in the past than we give them credit for now. And that one could envision a situation in which a museum tries to highlight those stories and then is accused of trying to, you know, they're only doing it because it's, you know, the woke thing or the trendy thing or that, but really, you know, they're better representing the past. So how have you seen museums try to remedy these, you know, oversights, these omissions in history? And how would you recommend to museums who want to start fixing some of these oversights and omissions take action now?
Well, I first thing I'll say is I'm gonna manage my own expectations and overpromising and underdelivering by saying, I don't have all the answers. What I have is, I think, a commitment to an approach, which is to collaborate and work together, and to bring whatever, ideas and exposure. I've been around to many different places around the world. I've been very fortunate as a scholar and as a researcher. When studying, for instance, cultural heritage, to have gone from everywhere to like UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Malaysia and Japan and also Butte, Montana. I've been sort of very aware of the Maywa Society in Butte, Montana, that runs this wonderful historical society and a little museum that's all about one of the largest Chinese populations in the American West was in Butte, Montana. And there's barely any trace of that anymore, and yet the folks who run that society now have done an amazing job of honoring that past. And it's not that they have a model; it's that I know many experiences in my own life of seeing people who want to do something, and maybe they need to have a good brainstorming with a lot of people who also will believe in their vision of what they want to do, help out with creating a vision, help out with a collaborative process, which may involve local indigenous, communities, a recognition again that diverse past includes also a colonial process of clearing indigenous peoples into reserves, that includes residential school, that are hard pasts, that are part of that legacy. You can't bite off everything, but I think acknowledging some of those darker aspects of the past and then embracing the desire to work together to create a collective past that also can be the foundation for a collective future. To me, that is a process. That's a process that requires bringing people together. It requires sometimes difficult conversations over food, and that can be a series of really discussions. To me, it's the right approach. It's about relationships. It's about building trust. It's about talking about what it is that you want to see. And then, individuals, people, some people, they just want to see this organization that they've devoted long time and energy and volunteer time to. They want to see that survive and thrive, right? And that's the number one goal. To me, that's more than enough to kind of say, okay, well, let's think about how to have something thrive and how to have something that the local school children can, really see as a support and a resource to, as they learn about the world and they learn about placemaking, about where they are and what that past means and what the future means. So to me, that's why I'm a historian. If I was a historian because I love dates, I would have failed. I almost failed, just full disclosure. I almost failed History 12 because I couldn't memorize dates. I couldn't get when the treaty of this was and the Bretton Woods, was that a forest or was it an animal or was it a clothing line? To me, I'm a historian because I care about the future. And any future, that is really collective and together, that brings people together, is founded upon a collective past. You cannot exclude people from a collective past and expect them to partake in a common future. And that's where, again, whether it's museums, whether it's classrooms, whether it's just, TV programs that are documentaries on the History Channel. I have a lot of belief that the 15th, 16th century essay, perfected, hundreds, is not the only vehicle for bringing people together. Short films, exhibits, field trips, eating together, cooking workshop together. These are ways to bring people into a common past and a common future. I tell my students all the time, it takes a great writer to write something so well that it will move someone to tears. a hack filmmaker can do the same, because, you know, you can, if you film someone speaking very emotionally about what they care about this, their story, about their past, about their family, a viewer will be, you know, will be moved, because it's the person sharing the story, not the filmmaker's technique. You know, he or she's just got to get out of the way of the story. Whereas writing is much harder. You know, the writer's sort of role in conveying a story is much larger. And that's why Fred Waugh, there's a reason why he's, you know, a Canadian poet laureate. And, you know, Fred Waugh can write to a point where him writing about a small town cafe will move you to laughter, move you to tears. But, you know, hopefully we can get community members and students and, you know, people who don't, they're not particularly good at filmmaking, but they can still help capture stories, collect them and preserve them for our collective sharing in the future, and be able to share them with for generations to come. So it's also about technique and what it is that, as I said, text panels, the ugly truth about museum text panels, majority of people who go to a museum exhibit don't read the text panels. So if we put all our energy into the text panels, guess what? We're not going to succeed. Those who read text panels, yeah, that's great. But we need other means of reaching people and of sharing stories, film. You know, again, I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in terms of VR, AR and all this. But that's also expensive and may not. They're just tools. You know, they're tools for a purpose. And so we've worked, you know, with the Center for Digital Media and others to try to use new technologies. But technologies are just a tool in our minds, too. That again, UBC, we have great access to some of these tools, but they have to be in partnership and collaboration with those who have to deliver, you know, a common goal, which is to reimagine who we are and where we are and our future together.
And that's really interesting that you bring up the role of storytelling versus writing, because I think broadly in the kind of classical museum institutional hierarchy, the curators with PhDs who write text panels are typically closer to the top, and the frontline programming people are historically closer to the bottom of the hierarchy. And yet what you're saying is basically that hierarchy needs to be flipped, because it's those frontline people who are engaging people and sharing their passion in a human to human method. Like, that's where the engagement takes place.
Yeah. And, you know, I just full disclosure, some of my best friends are PhDs and curators. You know, and again, we worked wonderfully with Vivian Gosselin, a PhD and a wonderful curator. And, you know, again, Denise Fong is now doing her PhD in interdisciplinary studies at UBC. Sharanjit Sandra, I'm very proud of Sharn for defending her PhD thesis recently. And so we've got a lot of people who are, but I think one of the things that hierarchy that you pointed out, that the expert, you know, a curator, again, you know, this is full disclosure, I have a PhD, and, you know, does it mean that I should be going around telling people what their stories is and the meaning of their stories? No, I it's a privilege to me to be a researcher and a scholar. And I get to indulge my curiosity. I get to go and ask questions and work with people on, but that idea that programming is below the curatorial, I think it's one of the things we have to actually really examine. You know, one of the classic processes is the exhibit's done and then passed on to the educational programmers and the people who then, you know, and then the curatorial moves on to something else. That's an efficiency, you could say, that is a privilege of medium to large scale museums. And really larger scale one. That's not a luxury that most small, you know, institutions can afford, where it's all hands on deck all through the process. And so to me, a way in which we can work with especially smaller museums and all the way through to medium size. And I think it was such a wonderful process, the way in which Burnaby Village Museum and their Across the Pacific exhibit Again, full credit to Lisa Codd and you know, the crew at BVM, as well as again Vivian and MOV, the way that we worked with collaboratively with community members. So it was an ongoing process. It wasn't just a check at the beginning, check just before it opens, and then leave the experts to do their work. It was about working iteratively. You know, iterative means every month, and you know, co-creating something, collaborative, and UBC having a role again of, we have research, we had lots of students working on things. And so to me, that creates something that we're all proud of, and it doesn't stop. It shouldn't stop when the exhibit door opens. That programming element, you know, we have a garden out front. That was really an idea that our students, normally, you know, you raised food and like the, my sister was trained as a librarian, and one year for her birthday, we gave her this little doll that was the shushing librarian doll, which is like, you know, it shushes people. And this idea that libraries should be quiet, same with museums, no food, no drink, no joy, right? You're there in the temple of learning, this didactic 19th century, you know, place where it's a temple to, you know, to your learning what you're supposed to know, a one-way, you know, process. I think obviously that's a 19th century museum. We have science centers. We have all these more dynamic, interactive, engaged ways that we create museum spaces. And I think that's part of it, is that food, drink. Yeah. Maybe food should be more centered. And for the MOV, we put sort of a garden, a growing, the backyard garden to pay homage to the Chinese, but also the, you know, Hungarian and the Italian backyard gardens in East Van and South Van, and put that out on the pristine lawn, again, as a kind of way of, and now, do I wish that would have also kind of invaded the interior space of the exhibit? Yeah, if we created a bunch of banquet tables at a seat at the table within MOV. The original idea before COVID was that we could have gatherings here. We could have food. We could literally, it was a kind of an homage to restaurant spaces, but we had tablecloths. We had tables. We could have had events and we could have grown things in the front yard garden and consumed them inside. I think rethinking the spatial bounds of the museum. There was another idea that we should have food trucks in the parking lot and, you know, create much more porousness in terms of the ways we imagine a museum space. You know, science centers have done an amazing job of really blowing up these 19th century distinctions of didactic spaces that are one way. And, you know, I know that lots of my friends and colleagues within the museum world would like to see a lot of that happen too, but it takes resources. It takes, and I think that's where the under-resourcing of the museum sector and of the cultural sector in general is causing challenges that aren't the fault of anybody within the industry itself, you know, finding jobs, finding ways to support young people to come in. To me, diversifying the museum sector and the cultural sector, one of the least diverse sectors in Canada, is about creating opportunities and resources for younger people to come in. And that's why these partnerships that we had of our students at UBC, who are very diverse, they come from around the world, from all kinds of different backgrounds, you know, the very act of getting them engaged with museums, but also creating pathways. So there's not you've had your moment and then there's nothing there in that world for you. So you might as well go become a barista at Starbucks because that's the jobs available. I think creating new jobs, creating new openings, creating, and that may involve actually confronting those hierarchies you raised. Whether the entry-level things in programming, which are just considered at the bottom of the hierarchy, whether it requires some rethinking about what's the museum of the future and the importance of programming and community engagement. Because again, our museums are public places, even if they're not publicly funded. They are engaging with a set of publics, and that's the programming. The exhibit as a designed space, like an architect designs a building, but the curatorial function perhaps is less of an aesthetic set of choices purely than these engagements. And I'm preaching to the choir. Lots and lots of people within the museum world agree. It's the resources to do it well that I think is missing.
Yeah, you know, I often say when talking to government that our sector is really good at doing more with less, but we could also do more with more.
Yeah.
Think about how much more we could do with more.
Yeah.
Because you're right, that under-resourcing. Before 2017, BC spent less per capita on culture than anywhere else in the country. So, our proverbial cupboards are pretty bare after a very, very lean period of time.
And to me, that is the opportunity. It is the truth. You're absolutely right. There's an under-resourcing. And I'll put this right to the anti-racism and other processes that we are in the midst of. You know, anti-racism is not some commitment in word only. You know, I think most of us are tired of claims that we're not racist. It's like, whatever. Like, what are you doing? And for a sector that, to me, doing means, making arguments about why, anti-racism requires one of the single most important areas of public education, our museum sector, to me, as important as K-12 classrooms, because it reaches a broader public. It helps either reinforce and amplify what's being taught in classrooms, or it cuts against it. So mixed messaging is not a good thing either. And so for me, the museum sector is crucial, and that's the opportunity. And if we're able to make arguments that if we're serious, and I think this current provincially, I think currently our government in this province is open to these kinds of arguments. We've seen it in the commitments to new museum spaces, to the Minister of Tourism, Arts and Cultures, who oversees it, I believe understands. But we've got to make those arguments, and we've got to be willing to not only make them, but follow through and mean them and mean it and say, if you give us this kind of funding, this is the purpose, this is the outcomes that we promise, but you've got to properly fund us. So that and it's not empty rhetoric then, so to me, that's where we are. And that's why also ACRE, that's why this aspirational partnership for the future, that's why this is to me the beginning of a set of collaborations we hope that will bring new life to a sector that requires more resources, that requires a visions that are collaboratively created with partners, whether small museums in rural spaces that maybe people think have been forgotten, as well as big city, big institutions, whether in Victoria, Vancouver. So I'm excited. I look forward to it. I'm so happy, Ryan, Lorinda, and all of you at BC Museums Association, and all the membership of the BC Museum Association represented by the board. We're excited for this beginning partnership. And we're excited also to build with the relationships that we already have enjoyed with small museums and local, civic museums.
Yeah, so we have an audience. There are people watching us speak, which is frightening. And I have a little bit more I want to talk to you about, but I do want to use this as an opportunity to have people start to think about any questions they might want to raise. To the audience, you can either write a question in the chat and we can talk about it. You can put your hand up and we can spotlight you to ask it verbally. So this is your start the questions percolating warning for everyone. And kind of as a last thought, I was invited yesterday to attend question period at the legislature because BC Museums Week, and there was a shout out given by the government. And as I'm sure everyone watching and participating knows, the province has just made an announcement of $876 million towards modernizing the Royal BC Museum. And I would say thus far, there's been a pretty significant backlash if you're looking at, you know, social media as a barometer of that. And a lot of people, you see the same line repeated time and again that, you know, we have a doctor shortage, we have a housing crisis, we have an overdose crisis, people can't afford to live, gas prices are through the roof. Why waste money on a new museum? And I was just, you know, that makes me then think, oh, like, do museums on the grand scale of all the government could be spending money on, do they matter? Do they rank? Is that a waste of money? And as a self-admitted museum fan, Henry, I was just wondering, like, how do you see the utility, the use, the role of museums in Canadian society at this point in time?
Yeah. I'm going to give a parallel to where I work, which is I work at a university. You know, if you ask the same questions, what's the utility of having $1 billion+ university that, you know, what do they do? Like, they teach people all how useless. I remember when I was I could be a lawyer, and my parents wanted me, they wouldn't have minded if I was a doctor, but I just didn't like blood. So that goes back to your introducing me as a doctor, sort of like, no, I don't, that medical profession, which it's almost like a joke stereotype of, you know, oh, you're Chinese, you want to be a doctor when you graduate. And to me, it's like historian, how useless, or scholar, how even more useless. To me, the undervaluing of culture, not just for culture's sake, but even with utility arguments, you know, UBC, I think 30 years ago, people might have questioned more funding for a university. What a waste. You know, it should be into our resource industry, into these things that are real jobs, and da 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 da. Frankly, UBC, I think, has over the last 30 years proven that, you know, the kinds of multiplier effects that happen when you invest in education and culture, when you invest in human capital, when you invest in making people more creative, more engaged, more aware, more able to solve problems, more able to analyze and look around and see what's needed, and then knowing what a Gantt chart, knowing what a, you know, Excel spreadsheet is, and being able to carry it out. I always say, you know, when I'm an administrator, I've been cursed to be an administrator here at UBC too. But, you know, when someone comes up with a great idea, I say, that's fantastic. I'm glad you've been learning in class and you've been listening. It's like, and I'm going to tell you, do you know what a Gantt chart is? Do you know what an Excel spreadsheet is? If you don't, your dream is not an implementable dream. It's going to die in the vine as just a wonderful idea that you could share over drinks or over Starbucks at a coffee shop, and it'd be great. But you might as well phone up a radio talk show and tell them about it. You want to get it done, figure out what a Gantt chart is, figure out what an Excel spreadsheet is, and start winning friends and, you know, winning over people and stakeholders. And who do you need to be on side? Who do you need as allies? Who do you need? And to me, that's where museums are right now. If it's just about $876 million and could you spend every dollar better somewhere else? It's like, that to me is a fruitless argument. It's like investing in culture, investing in education, investing in people, investing in the children, the K-12 that are going to go through those doors. And what are they going to learn about who we are, who they are, where they are, and the future? We've been badly educating through a colonial system, which is trying to convince Indigenous children they don't matter, right? Or actively even trying to erase their culture, language, and life, leading them to horrific outcomes. Education's not been a great thing for much of our colonial history. It's been a weapon. It's weaponized colonial takeover and dispossession. I'm just going to be frank. That's our education system for much of our history. And that's included museums. And yes, museums have tried to shift and pivot, but we're dealing with structure that's still not diverse enough, not visionary enough, not well-funded enough. And if you want to keep arguing about whether we should keep it underfunded and keep creating crappy outcomes with a crappy system and crappy structure, then yeah, go ahead and argue whether that money should go into healthcare and things. But if you want to change the world, you change the world first to invest in people, in what they themselves know, what they themselves aspire to want in the world. And that requires them recognizing and acknowledging our past, who we have been, this colonial history, this colonial structure of education, and turning that into something else, pivoting towards something where we have a future together and we're not weaponizing education to exclude, to erase, to ignore our non-white populations and their history. And it's not to center it only those histories. It is to acknowledge those pasts and to, again, come up collectively, collaboratively with a future together. And museums are crucial. Should all of that go just to the RBCM? That's a question for actually Gantt charts and Excel spreadsheets. Not all of our provincial dollars for education and higher education go into UBC. I'm good with that. I have many colleagues in universities around the province that they are an important part of our education system. I want them to be funded too. And so distribution of funding, how much funding in the cultural sector should go to help those under-resourced institutions around the province that do require more funding and more support. Yeah, the actual Gantt chart and Excel spreadsheet issues, but more money for the sector itself, I'm not going to argue against that. And in fact, I think arguing more vociferously for funding, and I'm glad that this provincial government has recognized that that underfunding that's been historical needs to change if we're going to change the sense of who we are and who we're going to be in this province.
Yes, extremely well said. And I sometimes feel like maybe this is me getting a little tinfoil hat-y, but I feel like it's not. It's true. So hear me out. If then, for most of their existence, especially in Canada, especially in America, but all over the world, museums have been a tool of reinforcing the status quo, yeah, then any attempt to decolonize or change or radically alter how museums function in our society is then kind of an attack on the status quo and seeks to depower people who benefit from the status quo. And therefore that is a political action. So I feel like increasingly we're seeing that when museums attempt to use a different playbook, they're met with really severe blowback and pushback from, you know, conservative, right-wing, neoconservative, whatever your term of choice is, yep, groups. You know, I'm thinking the Museum of Us in San Diego, rebranded from Museum of Man, implemented an extremely ambitious repatriation policy. And shortly thereafter, Tucker Carlson on Fox News did a hit piece talking about, I'm just asking questions about why the woke mobs are canceling history, like that kind of thing that he does. And, you know, because I think he benefits from the status quo and is therefore threatened by that museum action. So I guess my question at the end of this ramble is, yeah, if museums are going to more and more try to challenge bad status quos and fight for anti-racism and equity, how do we also get community on board with those changes? So when there is that pushback, yeah, it's not then the Tucker Carlsons of the world kind of getting the mob with the pitchfork and the torches to start banging at the doors.
Yeah. You're asking really, really, I think, important questions, challenging questions, difficult questions. I'll start with first principles, which is I count many of those kinds of voices as minoritarian voices at this present moment. We're lucky that they're minoritarian voices. Now, does that mean that there isn't a possible majority that could be rallied around it? As in the past 100 years ago, when you could, you know, get elected around white supremacy. Now, again, back in those days, you had to disenfranchise all non-whites in order to get democratic majorities, you know, to vote for white supremacy. In other words, only whites could vote, then it's not so hard to get a majority to say everything for us. You have to disenfranchise everyone else. 1871, 1872 is to disenfranchise Indigenous people, disenfranchise Chinese, so they couldn't vote. We are now living in a society where, where it's a democratic society. So I would say counting on expertise, counting on a small number of, say, wealthy donors, let's just use that alone, and saying we're going, that's the status quo. And we can survive as a museum with a handful of, you know, people who were willing to, you know, align our story with, to support them, and ignore the majorities of our society. I think that's a losing formula. You could say that that has been a 19th century museum formula. You just have to go look at the great museums and which, who were the quote robber barons that supported the Rockefellers. It's wonderful to have donors, but it can't be that the museum is aligned with a small number of people who benefit from the status quo. So yeah, museums, they have to be places. And I would say this for the cultural heritage sector in general. We've gone in heritage, just to shift it over to a parallel area that I also spent a lot of time in. Heritage used to be based around experts like me. If I said this is significant, then as a PhD, then it's significant because my expert statement of significant and report and all these kinds of stuff makes it significant. Heritage has moved to one where intangible cultural heritage, what a community cares about in terms of its own cultural heritage, matters because it is something that therefore protects an institution, a cultural heritage institution or a site or anything, with a broad support, with a large number of stakeholders who believe in the vision. And that's the answer to how do you, you know, move to the future of museums or cultural heritage sites or all these kinds of things in a way that protects you from the reaction of a small number of people who don't want things to change, by making sure that you have those allies. You know, a woke mob is also about the fear of a Tucker Carlson, about a large number of people wanting to see change and supporting it. And, you know, whether you want to use the term woke mob or, look, a large amount of our community wants to have a more inclusive museum and that we all see ourselves in, that not only a small minority going in see themselves mirrored, that the museum is a public space, a commons for a community to see itself and to see itself both in the past and in a future and in the present in a way where the people who go in, you know, can be emotionally affected, can feel a connection. The biggest problem with museums is if people don't want to go, or when they go, they don't feel affected by it, they don't feel moved, you got a problem. You know, you can't blame the audience for being bored by your movie. Right? Nobody says the problem with this movie isn't that it sucks. The problem is all the audience sucks and don't like this movie. You're not going to make many movies that way. And so it's not about, you know, entertainment, like, a, you know, using the movie example. Museum is an important place. If you can't actually create something that engages your audience, that's our problem, not theirs. And that's the politics of protecting the directions we want to go. Decolonizing is not like and here's my last sort of thing about the political process of change, is that, you know, there's going to be pushback for anything we do. You know, if we want to, you know, create museum spaces that address that past, the colonial past, and you know, decolonization, I'm not sure. There's many people who have problems with that term even, but I would say that one of the things that I think, a process in which the same people determine a new book, that's not our problems. You know, creating more engaged spaces with a broader set of stakeholders, the real stakeholders who also include the people who, you know, are the taxpayers that do provide the money. We have to convince, you know, a lot of people this is the right way to go. And so that is inherently a political process. It can't be driven by the same people. So we don't decide we're going to decolonize. The same people running museums say, we're going to decolonize now. Before we were colonial, now we're going to decolonize. And it's like, but it's the same set of people in the room. And then, you know, even if you go, oh, let's bring in one person, you know, let's bring in one person who's Chinese, let's bring in one person, and then they have a seat at the table as we go and switch what we're doing, but the table remains the same. You got to change the table. And so I think whether in governance, whether in thinking about the importance of audience and the programming as being the lead, you know, versus one curator or one set of people determining the future, that's actually not decolonizing. Colonial processes are top-down. Colonial processes are driven in some sense by a small set of people, you know, making decisions for their own interests at the expense of others. Colonial hierarchies are generally driven, well, by hierarchies. And so I would say that whether it's in the questions of governance and the questions of who you're collaborating with, and again, not that UBC is the answer. It's just that there are enough of us here at UBC, you know, and I would count many of my wonderful colleagues, places like, you know, MOA, the Museum of Anthropology, who have been for decades, you know, trying to also help in processes of doing things differently, doing things better, doing things in a more collaborative way. That's tough, you know, is if you want to overturn a long history of, you know, having bad relationships with communities, whether it's indigenous communities or non-white communities, Asian communities, then overturn the relationships, create better relationships, and then decide together. And then you have the support. Then you actually have the best kind of support, which is who's on your side on this, who's willing to cover your back and to protect your flanks. It is in some sense a political process, and people will be deluded if they think it's a decision made at a board table and that unilaterally you can decolonize. That is not the way it works.
Thank you. And I'll just remind the audience that if there's any questions, we are nearing the end of our session. And I thought I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the MOU that the BCMA has signed with ACRE. So if I'll talk about the MOU as people have an opportunity to think of any questions that they might want to ask. So I really love how you talked about changing the table and changing who's around the table and finding ideas to do that. So the BCMA has signed an MOU with ACRE, and there's not really one clear deliverable or project that's going to be born out of that relationship yet. But in a nutshell, what we're hoping to do is have a number of conversations, both as an organization and with ACRE and with members over the coming years that offer new ideas and experiments and solutions and challenges and provocations for how we can do some of that work of changing the tables up a little bit. We're super excited to be able to partner with UBC and with ACRE. And if things feel a little nebulous now, I think that's somewhat by design, because yeah, we are in that process of building relationships and pulling people into conversations. So I really appreciate, Henry, that you've been able to have this chat today, because this is going to be the first of many conversations that we have as a group.
Yeah. No, and thanks for, again, my thanks personally, and also on behalf of our team at UBC, to the board at BCMA, as well as Ryan and your staff as well, to kind of take that chance with us. And I said, what I'm committing to is not to have the answers. You know, I've said something very strongly about process and I just to echo that, we are not coming from UBC as the doctors with the answers. We're not going to diagnose anything. We're not that kind of doctor. You know, what we're very good at, and what our students are very good at, is to bring our talents that they have, our capacity to work with you, And I think the MOU for me is an agreement that, yeah, there's a need to work together, to come together and to share resources, share even goals. That if all I cared about was advancing my research career, nothing to do with these kinds of MOUs. We don't get paid to be engaging with the community, let's just say. What we, I think the ACRE side is that we believe in working collaboratively with communities, including museum sector and museum institutions, cultural heritage institutions, so that, you know, we can advance something that's mutual to us. And I think the MOU to us is about the start of discussions and conversations about how we can bring our capacity. We want to be at the table, a table that's changing, you know, and if the table before didn't have strong commitment from universities, that's what we represent too, is a commitment to bringing what we do well and to even reshape some of that and say, well, we think we do it well because we've been doing it within a particular set of tables that has certain goals, but maybe we should be actually rethinking some of these goals. And we're happy to work with your members to reshape even the goals. As I said, I think, in our previous collaborative, work with museums that I mentioned, we weren't coming in to say we want to do X and you have to come along with us. It's like and I'm so thankful to all of the previous kind of collaborative partners we've had, that we were able to have these kind of discussions that take a little bit more time. We don't come in with the answers. We start with some questions and come up with some things to do together. And so that's again why we're excited and why I'm so thankful to BCMA for taking that chance that we're going to, be in a better place in 3 years, 5 years, because we will be working together towards something versus I think just any other way of doing it, where it's something that's self-interested in a way that doesn't work.
I like to think that I'm a big believer in collaboration and try to work, that more people working together produces more interesting outcomes than people working in silo. And I think that one of the things that excites me most about the BCMA is that we get to work with members who have such diverse collections and experiences and ideas. And, no two there's great similarity in the museum sector, but each community and each museum have their own unique cultural contexts and ways of doing things. And the more we can facilitate people talking about those unique cultural contexts, I think the better results we'll have as a sector.
And that kind of, again, I know that museum professionals, those who have been in the sector for a long time, that under-resourcing creates sometimes counterproductive effects, a sense that you're competing for money or you're, this and that. And to me, bringing more resources, from perhaps also, sources that didn't exist before, they're one of the wonderful things about being at UBC is that, we have access to particular kinds of grants, social science, humanities, research. I just used the example very specifically of a seat at the table at the Museum of Vancouver and at Chinese Canadian Museum. Some of the digital tech things that was because we were partnered and we could bring, other sources of funding to bring in the Center for Digital Media's, some of the work on community oral histories. If these were things that we had already had collected for 10 years for Chinese Canadian stories that Denise Fong had oversaw, so we had lots of, to use the cold-blooded term, assets brought together with the assets that Museum of Vancouver had. But just to be totally honest too and blunt, collections that were collected over 100 plus years from a colonial fashion, underrepresented, unarchived, uncollected communities. That's one of our challenges. You know, there's going to be a wonderful film coming out in the National Film Board. So all of you hopefully can look out for it. The title of the documentary is Unarchived. And Imogene Lim, my colleague at Vancouver Island University, Satwinder Bains, Dr. Bains from University of Fraser Valley, she's also prominent in there. There's also folks who talk about collecting, you know, queer, you know, archives, communities that didn't belong in the archives, except as targets or surveillance. You know, how do unarchived communities, Indigenous communities as well, that have been collected but only in a particular way, you know, and that's something that, again, is my colleagues at MOA, you know, have a hyper awareness of, you know, but then others like Chinese Canadian collections, there's barely such a thing. And yet out in community collections, out in the, you know, places where that kind of erasure actually didn't take place, that there's stuff in there, but perhaps they're in Chinese language and there's not a capacity within a small town who's there to read some of the stuff that's there that is been collected. So sharing resources, pooling resources, collaborating, bringing in sources of grants and money and leveraging those that perhaps aren't as available if you're working alone, or if it's only the museum sector. I think these are some of the things also, just in a very practical, pragmatic way, is also part of, I think, working with BCMA, but also in our earlier collaborations with museums, is in an under-resourced, want to see more resources, and we want to find ways to actually bring in, the kinds of things that allow us to do things well and to do things that are new.
Well, thank you so much for your time with us today and to be able to kind of bring this partnership out to our community. Really appreciate everything we've been able to talk to today. I was mentally making quotes constantly while you were talking today. There's so many great things that I look forward to sharing in future conversations. Again, if there are people listening who want to learn more about ACRE or want to talk to other organizations about partnerships or co-applying for grants, I really encourage you to reach out, because we would love to help make those connections and facilitate those introductions. So before I throw to Lorenda to wrap up, I'll ask you the perennial wrap-up question. If people want to learn more, where can they visit?
So there's a new website, but I don't think it's been optimized for Google search yet, because it's literally that new. But I'm going to throw out Jennifer Liu. Jenny's on right now, and maybe she can throw her email down, just that she's much more organized than I am. Now, when I talked about Gantt charts and Excel spreadsheets and people who are really good at program management and things like that, that's not me. I'm not describing myself. I'm describing some of our wonderful team members who are much more. So Jenny or Jennifer Liu, she's a person that can be emailed, contacted, and especially if it's just to kind of have a chat. She also controls my life and calendar. But also, I would say, you know, website Lorenda put it up. Thank you. That's, you know, the kind of placeholder for now for the site. There's Jennifer's contact. Again, we're happy to kind of explore. My sense is that, you know, one of the wonderful things about working with Ryan and BCMA through his leadership and that of his staff is that that's a clearinghouse for all of the museums in British Columbia. But we are also happy to talk about things that we can do that are more one-on-one, if that makes sense too. So again, we look forward to it, and you know, and as I said, I think for many of you, you know, we're also happy to talk about what's in your own collections and things that you yourself run. You know, I was saying it was part of this unarchived film. So it's, you know, the silencing of people, you know, historically, you know, it's actually made a lot of noise. You know, if you don't realize that the process of silencing, the process of trying to suppress, in itself is a very noisy process, and so that leaves traces all over the place too. And so, in some sense, that may be what you also have evidence of, so to speak, in your own collections. But it's also, you may have evidence of life that just was, that fell through the cracks. I always think of C.D. Hoy's photos of, you know, nobody trained him to be a photographer. He had 21 different jobs in all these different places around BC. And then he learned how to use a camera and he took pictures of everyone around him in Quebec, Quesnel Forks and Barkerville. And that's our truest, most unadulterated, unfiltered, you know, representations of what it was like, and that diversity, that past that has been forgotten. And so even there, I think that's where all around the province, those gems still remain. And so we look forward to uncovering those out of that processing of silencing and erasure and forgetting. There's lots that to be recollected, remembered, and recovered. So we look forward to that process. And thanks again to Ryan, BCMA, and Lorenda, and others who really have been great partners.
Thank you. I'm gonna grasp the sound of silence as being my takeaway conclusion point there. I'm just gonna take the screen share and move us forward as we wrap up. Similar to Ryan, Dr. Yu, I'm left with many quotes that will be sounding in my mind the rest of the day. I'm just going to move us past the question slide as we navigated that earlier. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for Henry and Ryan for sharing your time and ideas with us. BC Museums Week 22 continues. Join us for tomorrow's lecture on truth-telling as a precursor to reconciliation. And on Friday, May 20th, for How We Can Build a Better Future. The BCMA offers many ways to connect with the vibrant arts, culture, and heritage community in BC. During BC Museums Week, we'll be highlighting more of the exclusive BCMA member benefits available. Use your exclusive BC Museums Week promo code JOINBCMA2022 for a 25% off discount to all new membership applications. And lastly, we encourage members to visit the new BCMA OWL Academy at school.museum.bc.ca and explore our new selection of online courses. BCMA members get a 50% off discount, and with your purchase, you'll have lifetime access to learning content. Thank you again, Ryan, Henry, our interpreters, Alana and Jen. There are lots of wonderful resources in this chat. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at it, please do. Try to get some of those links up online and available for you as well. Have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you so very much for joining us.